for this afternoon and tonight, a significant winter storm, including heavy snow with unlimited trainings.
Hello, and welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge on to you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, a professional mountain guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains. I recently realized that over 90% of my injuries and hospital visits have occurred in foreign countries. I broke my kneecap skiing in Japan. I blew my ACL skiing in Argentina. I got 6 stitches in my forehead surfing in Chile. I got dengue fever surfing in Indonesia. I tore my MCL and opened a 3-inch gash in my knee skiing in Argentina. Skied into a rock wall for some reason. And just this summer, I got terrible sciatica and had to get IV drugs and anti-inflammatories surfing in Nicaragua. And I got labyrinthitis surfing in the Maldives this summer. It's been a hell of a summer. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Technology, innovation, and design is the name of the game, and it's exactly what Scott Sports is. It's in their DNA. Skiing is about testing yourself, seeing the possibilities that you are presented with, and pushing yourself to seize the greatest challenges. Scott Sports has the gear to help you do just that. To learn more, check out scottsports.com and see what real innovation looks like. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Alta, an independent ski area where the soul of skiing continues to live on for 84 winters. Alta is a skiers-only mountain celebrated for its frequent powder days, averaging 540 inches of snowfall each winter. My guest today is Doug Staup. Doug has been to the North and South Poles more than any other person on Earth. Doug has been to Antarctica 42 times. He's mountaineered all over the world, including the Himalayas' Amma Diblam and Earth's 6th highest peak, Choi Yu. He's guided and skied for the camera with Warren Miller. And Doug is the founder and owner of Ice Axe Expeditions, a guiding service that takes people all over the world, including Antarctica, the North Pole, South Pole, Iceland, Greenland, Svalbard, the Amazon, and much more. This guy has done a ton, and I can't wait to find out more with you right now. Well, Doug, I want to start here by giving our listeners a little background to our relationship. So we've known each other quite a long time. I was actually trying to get work with you, I think, as early as 2012. And we even lived together for a bit in Tahoe last season. Thanks again for letting me crash with you. And I've been guiding for your company, Ice Axe Expeditions, since 2014, with 5 trips to Antarctica and 3 trips to Svalbard in the Arctic Circle. And we've spent some really good time together in Tierra del Fuego in Argentina as well. Well, let's start with some rapid fire questions before digging down into some of the more just crazy and unexpected attributes of your life that I think are really interesting. So here we go. Rapid fire. How many times have you been to the North Pole?
17.
Holy shit.
Including one crossing from Siberia to the North Pole in 2005, unsupported.
Oh my gosh. So how many polar bears encounters have you had on all those 17 trips?
Probably close to 27 polar bear encounters.
And which encounter with a polar bear was the craziest?
Well, all of them. But yeah, I've had a couple really close calls with some polar bears, including one with a good buddy of mine, Mark Cornelison, which he almost got mauled. He was actually a really, really cool story. He was doing his morning business and trying to release himself. And I was in the tent boiling some ice and snow to make water. That's how we do it on the polar plateaus. And then we had another Norwegian guy, Petter Nyquist, that was in the sleeping bag because we were exhausted. And I hear Mark scream, "He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me." And I unzip the tent, and about 5 meters away is a 12-foot tall polar bear standing on its hind legs. And Mark has a shovel in his hand trying to keep the polar bear at bay with his pants down by his ankles. And so he's screaming, "Grab the gun, grab the gun." I grab the gun. I load the gun. Petter's the gun guy. So he grabs the barrel of the gun, but he was in the sleeping bag. So it was at minus 50 degrees Celsius. And so he grabbed the metal barrel of the gun and ripped about 10 layers of skin off his hand. So he's screaming, Mark's screaming. It was a little bit chaotic, and we ended up shooting the gun in the air and scaring the bear away. So that was pretty close call. I mean, it's where they live. I had a lot of issues with it, and we were doing some climate change science. I designed some beacons that I placed on the ice to justify our trip, and you know, but it was really just more self-fulfilling prophecy of like trying to do something extreme. And you know, I had a lot of issues with how we were on this environment where these bears live, and they'd never seen humans before. So anyway.
Sounds like a hell of a way to wake up when one buddy's screaming with his pants off and your other buddy's screaming with his hand ripped off. And then now it comes down to you to scare the bear away. Well, and a 12-foot polar bear just outside your tent.
I really couldn't sleep a lot in that trip. And those guys were snoring, no big deal. We would actually do rock, paper, scissors to see who would sleep in the middle. And I had a lot of issues with it. The tent would flap. I would sit straight up. I would think of this a bear. And I didn't sleep much. But anyway.
I think I'd be the same. I have a hard time with black bears. I can imagine a polar bear, because you know, a polar bear is, I think, classified as a marine mammal, but you know, it's the, so a grizzly bear, I think, is the largest land predator, but really it's the polar bear. Jesus.
Yeah. It's really truly the only mammal that hunts man.
How many times have you been to the South Pole?
18 trips to the South Pole, 4 crossings of Antarctica, including one with a blind guy, 787 miles, 62 days. That was the first polar trip I really did. And that was the Hercules Inlet route. And from there to the pole was 62 days. And then I did another route. I did Ernest Shackleton's intended route of 1914 through 1916. And that was the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. So in 2007 and 8, I got dropped off at the Filter Ice Shelf. And then no one had done this route before. And we skied 47 days, me and an Irishman, nonetheless. And he was actually a jockey over in England as well. 2008, we did the first route of the Filter Ice Shelf to the pole, and that was about 737 miles, and we did that in 47 days, and he was certainly a good partner, and I got tons of stories to tell about that one. But I took a guy in a wheelchair, Aaron Anderson, who's a paraplegic, and he had a sit ski, and we climbed 9,000 feet, 3,000 meters from the Leverett Glacier to the top and then straight to the pole. And we did that in 24 days. And so we raised a whole bunch of money for childhood cancer. He had cancer at the age of 7 and then end up having a grapefruit sized tumor in his back. And he was never going to walk again, but he does all kinds of amazing stuff. Aaron Anderson. We did go up the Leverett Glacier, which is had some controversy. I don't know if you remember Colin O'Brady, but there was a lot of controversy of Colin coming down the Leverett Glacier, which is basically a polar highway of sorts that the South Pole Station gets fuel from McMurdo, called the South Pole Overland Traverse. And they drag these piston bullies and fuel bladders over this thing. So you do have a little bit of a paved road, but a flattened road with some of the sastrugi. So, but still, I mean, I was blown away by Aaron pushing, especially up that hill. I didn't help him one bit. I mean, my sled probably weighed 400 pounds, but I was like, I'd look back at him, how he's pushing. It was like, damn, I got two legs. And I'm like, that guy's freaking amazing. So certainly you learn a lot about those. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about, you know, the people you're with. And I think that's what's really special about them is the camaraderie and the friendships that you make on some of these like really interesting polar journeys. And I was actually talking about it on the plane yesterday with somebody. And I said, you forget about all the bad stuff and the agony and the suffering that you really do. And you sort of can't wait to do it again. So I think I'm a little bit not really together on those things because I can't wait to go do another one.
Well, I think it's safe to say that you're not exactly normal, Doug. Those extreme type two, you know, to enjoy that stuff and to be able to look away from it and forget about it so quickly. You know, one of the stories that I actually was going to wait till later, but I'd love to hear you do it now, is you had to pull your tooth out once on the polar plateau and near the South Pole. Tell us about that, because that is so messed up.
Yeah, that was with that was with Richard. And, you know, it's really interesting because I was with him for 47 days and I never really got to know him. that well, because obviously you stop 7 to 10 times a day and to eat and drink, and you're, you know, 2 feet from them or 3 feet from them while you're sitting on your sled eating and drinking. But within 5 minutes, your hands are cold and you want to start going again. But, you know, you're usually shoving like handfuls of nuts or chocolate or whatever in your mouth. Uh-huh. And so you don't really have a lot of time to converse. But one of those times that we stopped, I was shoving chocolate in my mouth and I'd broken one of my molars, my left upper molar. And, you know, it was okay at first. I was dealing with the pain, but then it just got, you know, ungodly. And it was actually split in half, you know, just imagine living in a freezer, you know? And, so everything's hard and cold and you sort of have to use your body to heat things up. Like even those goo packets or whatever, I'd usually try to warm them up in my armpit or something like that, and then be able to consume it. But, I was just so hungry. And so I broke one of my molars. I'm sitting there, I think we were like 3 or 4 days away from the pole. So we weren't that far, but I phoned the doctor in Union Glacier, saying, "Hey, what should I do?" And she said, "Is it possible you can pull it? Do you have some painkillers?"
Oh,
and
I was like,
and I was like, "Yeah, I think I can do that." And I didn't want to use the painkillers just in case, you know, I only had like a few left, and
I would have taken them.
And so I end up, and I had to take a Leatherman or a needle nose plier, and I pulled the one out, and I could hear my bone, jawbone break. And I had to add insult to injury. I had to take the other one and pull that one out too. So because it was split in two, but, I still have a hole there where my molar was. And, anyway, it was, just sort of the show must go on. And I think, 2 days later I, got snow blind as well. So I had like gauze where my tooth was, cause it continued to bleed for like a week. And I ended up, trying to navigate, it was a weird day. It sort of got a little bit warm and my goggles frosted up and I couldn't navigate at all, through my goggles. So I put them on my forehead and I started navigating, you know, and you almost could see the pole, even though you're 2 or 3 days away. So the navigation was pretty, you wanted to be pretty exact. And, I ended up, the next morning when I woke up, my eyes were completely swollen. And my one left eye was almost swollen shut. So I had gotten what's called snow blindness, or burn your retina is what happens. So I made a patch and, you know, and I had one tooth missing. And so we limped into the pole and made it in 47 days, but it was quite an encounter, and certainly proud of Richard to get through that and do this new route.
That's spectacular. I mean, it's just hard to even understand having to pull your teeth out, broken tooth in half. One, the first part must have been bad. The second one must have been so tender. And then be completely snowblind after that and have to navigate without your eyes, basically. That's impressive. And I want to take one step back just for our listeners. So that is cool that and really interesting that you did the Ernest Shackleton route with an Irishman, because Shackleton was Irish and so was this person that you did it with. So that's really special there, the jockey that you did it with. And then the wheelchair person that you did it with, you guys made a movie about that called The Push. Is that right?
No, that was Grant Corrigan. And we ended up doing a Last Degree. A Last Degree is 60 nautical miles. So we got dropped off on top of the polar plateau and we skied for 12 days. And in perspective, we skied 12 days and did 72 miles. Okay. With Aaron, we did 500 miles in 24 days and we climbed 9,000 feet or 3,000 meters. And it was just him and I, but we were filming, we were doing all kinds of stuff with The Push. So yeah, that was another, one that I do. And I like to engage in projects like that. It's not about getting to the pole and beating your chest. If we can find something to raise money for, I make all my clients raise money for charity, or I, you know, try to find a purpose in which I do all my trips, and it really makes sense for me. So, I keep doing it and I will continue to do it. And, all the people I take are amazing humans that are doing amazing things. And I'm just a facilitator for that.
Fantastic, Doug. I think I and many of us love what you do. It's amazing. It's inspirational. And it's hard to understand. Something I'll never do. I'll never even get close to that stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, I sometimes say I'm a professional sufferer.
Yeah, I mean, because you are. I mean, and maybe for our listeners, we should describe your physique. You know, you're a very large man. I don't know, your shoulders have got to be 3 feet wide. And then you're how tall and how much do you weigh, Doug? You're a beast.
I used to be 6'1". I think I'm more like 6 foot now. I think I'm shrinking. And let's just segue back, because I had a little, I had a heart issue recently.
Tell us about that.
So I lost a lot of weight with that. So I'm probably about 205 now, probably. Usually I was about 215, sometimes even 220. So pretty square kind of guy. But I do love paddling and skiing, and it really hasn't affected me that much. But back in April, I was ski guiding with a friend of mine, Bodie Miller and Eric Slopey and some other clients. And we were up in Haines, Alaska with Stellar heli operators. And we were doing some skiing, and I didn't feel well like the whole week. I felt really lethargic. I was a little bit nauseous with the food. I thought that was actually just the food, but I wasn't feeling myself. But I still went out on a few days, and we had a couple down days, but still went out and skied. And I think the last day was sort of the crescendo of the trip, and we had amazing conditions, beautiful bluebird, and chesty powder. So it was amazing, and I did 15 runs.
Whoa.
And that was, pretty long runs too. I would have to say like over 3,000 plus runs. So big day in the mountains with, some great people, and just really, really enjoyed it. And, but I was not feeling myself, and there was actually the telltale sign was, one of the skiers lost a ski, and I skied down first. So I had to like climb up and get the ski, and I took everything I had to wallow through, swim through the snow to get up, to get to her ski. And it was, that was like, something's not right with me at that point in time. And ended up flying back to the States. It was like before Easter, it was a Saturday before Easter Sunday. I didn't even go in on Sunday or Saturday. And I said, maybe I'll go in on Monday. And I even called one of my clients he's not even a cardiologist. He's a, a knee doctor. I didn't even, I said, hey, can you call in this, EKG for me? I'm going to go get checked in Renown, which is the hospital in Reno. And he said, yeah, I'll do that for you. And so I sort of taking this time to do that. And I end up going in, and within 5 minutes, there was probably 15 people around me, and need to deploy my family. And they thought I was really on my deathbed at that point in time, because I had a heart attack for over 12 days.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm fairly lucky, and I feel blessed that I was probably healthy enough that it didn't affect me that much. But, I had open heart surgery the very next morning and a double bypass. I had two arteries, which was a hereditary coronary disease I was unaware of. And I, had a big zipper on my chest and opened me up, and I feel great right now. And I have two new arteries, and I have at least another 57 years to live with eating healthy and doing the right thing. So I'm feel like strong as bull right now. So I feel like I'm not quite 100%. I went out for a 12-mile paddle this morning, and I just got back from the East Coast at like 2:30 in the morning. So I'm a little bit tired, but that's fairly normal, kind of thing. So I'm feeling strong. I got a race, paddleboard race next Saturday. So we'll see how I do. It's one of those things.
Well, thanks so much for sharing all that, Doug, about your experience with your heart and how you were able to recover from it. I think our listeners would agree with me. That's insane that you just flew in last night at 2:30 a.m. and you did a 12-mile paddle. I wouldn't be able to do that on a good day. So as a good sign, it looks like you're healing up well, which makes my heart soar like a hawk to hear that. Awesome. You're doing so well, man. So I'm really pumped to hear that. Really good news.
Thanks, man. It's good. I feel strong. I'm getting stronger every day. And I think just trying to work out and try to get in that threshold of, type 2 heart rate and trying to do all the right things. I have some really good people around me helping me with it too. So I'm blessed.
Absolutely. How many times have you been to Antarctica?
49 times. So that's insane. Yeah. And that's only in the last 22 years. So I did some government contracts where I flew in for the day and back. I did like 10 of those one time, and I don't really count those as trips to Antarctica. I count as a full-on expedition, whether I'm going to go ski or pull sleds or go to Vinson or whatever that looked like. So that was 49 expeditions, 29 to the peninsula. Wow. And I'll probably be down. It looks like I got a bunch of work down there this year. So it looks like 3 or 4 times I'll probably go down this year. So I'm looking forward to it. I miss it dearly. It's probably the favorite place for me to go and ski. by far. I think there's just something magical about the place, the pristineness, the cleanliness, and just, skiing to wildlife. You know, I think that's the really, truly special thing. And I think that's right. That's why I love Svalbard too. You know, you're skiing to wildlife. I mean, I ski Greenland and Iceland and Morocco and Kashmir. I guess there's monkeys in Kashmir, but most of those places you might encounter some wildlife, but it's not as plentiful as the Antarctic Peninsula, where you're skiing down to millions of penguins and thousands of seals and hundreds of whales. So there's just something really remarkable about that, you know?
It's spectacular.
Yeah. It's not really about the skiing, is it?
No. That's when I sell that trip, that's what I tell people. But all that wrapped together does make it the coolest ski trip in the world.
Yep. And I'm fortunate that I run a company that has started taking skiers. And I think that's been, Europeans have been doing it for, 50, 60 years, where they're hundreds of years, probably, where they're traveling from town to town and doing backcountry stuff. And, the equipment has certainly come, tenfold in the last decade. And, a lot of the American clients they've been to CMH and they've been to heli skiing all over the world, but they really haven't dive into the touring part. So it's one of the misconceptions with our trips is like, do I need to have experience? I'm probably not good enough. It's actually an ideal place for you to learn how to backcountry ski because you have a certified guide or, a guy like Miles that's taking you up and you have three other clients and beside yourself. And so you get a lot of that individualized instruction on how to do a kick turn and help with the skins and all the other stuff. So I find it more of an ideal place to learn how to backcountry ski.
I can attest that I've had beginning tourers on my rope down in Antarctica and they do great. We have a blast. Everybody has so much to learn. It's such a spectacular place. Everybody is just on cloud nine the whole time. And especially when you're skiing down to penguins every day, how can you ever be not in a fantastic mood?
Yeah, I agree.
So if you had to pick North Pole or South Pole, which would it be and why?
They're very different. The South Pole is a landmass. It's a big dome and it definitely gets cold temperatures, but it's very, you can deal with a lot of that cold, especially because of the solar illumination or the sun that warms you up in the tent. The North Pole is you're on sea ice that's constantly moving and breaking up and it has all these other challenges that it's in, it's always in flux. So that makes it very, very interesting and interesting to me for even navigation purposes. And, you're swimming and there's polar bears and there's other things that are very interesting for the trip. It's not just put your head down today we need to ski 10 miles and the equation changes quite a bit because of that drift that happens too. So it's like, it's a moving environment. So you have to, I've been in situations where you've skied 15 miles in a day and you set up a tent and then you get pushed back maybe 7 or 8 miles at night.
Oh.
So it plays havoc on your psyche. And, but I think I enjoy the North Pole more. It is a colder environment. It's a wetter cold. There's a lot more humidity, but there is something super special about it. And the South Pole, you actually get to a pole. So you can like see that and you can feel it. The North Pole is just a sort of a fictitious spot on the GPS that you find and it's always moving. So you're constantly trying to move to be at that South Pole and the GPS will say 90 degrees north. So
you're here.
You're here. And then where I don't like to call myself an explorer, I call myself more of an adventurer because, the turn of the century guys, they really, as soon as they got there, they had to turn around and go back. I get on my sat phone and put on my big down jacket and call them and say, come pick me up in a helicopter. So it's not the same, it's like, certainly, I give credit to where credit is due for the turn of the century explorers who are just amazing, who set the groundwork for people like myself.
And how many times will you swim a day and how does swimming work in the North Pole?
Okay. So what happens is you're coming, you basically are scanning the horizon and you sometimes see smoke on the water, which is black smoke. And that usually signifies an open water lead. And so I try to stay away from those. I navigate around them, but a lot of the time I am not, you have to, especially if it's low light or contrast conditions and you just sort of have to go north and use your compass and just go straight north. There's all kinds of pressure ridges and pressure ridges are caused by wind and current pushing the ice together. not only above the ice surface, but below like a keel on a boat. But, you know, there's a lot of times where there's a big open water and you're trying to go north and you look east and you look west. And there's just open water as far as you can see. So a lot of the times, you don't, if you have a really tight knit group of people that you're with, you'll just sort of put on the dry suit, swim the 15 meters that it takes with a rope on your sled, and you pull the rope across. And I've had to adapt and try new things as far as like drag kayaks along with me, bring dry suits. I usually do bring a dry suit, but if a group is fairly large and they haven't done a lot of swimming, you need some skills with that. So this last year, I was going to try to bring a pack raft. And that was sort of my new idea, you know, because they only weigh a few pounds and you'll inflate that and sort of drag it along and it'll drag behind your sled. And hopefully that'll work. I think you could probably get two people and ferry it back and forth and then just pull the sleds across. The sleds float too. So a swimming, you would encounter an open water lead. You'd throw in the dry suit. You'd swim sort of backstroke. I usually put my down jacket on. The water's warmer than the air. So the water is at right at 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So the water is usually warmer than the air. And so it's not like a bad place to be. So you just do backstroke. You certainly don't want to get wet. And I've only had, I could probably count on one hand the amount of times that I've actually fallen through the ice. And a lot of those decisions were, I could probably not fall in. I'll jump across the other side and be fine. But then I'd have my client, my team on the other side of the open water. So I would just sort of fall in and then sort of break the ice and work my way back to get to the back to the other side. And then, you know, set up a tent and run around the tent, you know, 150 times.
Whoa.
And get your client in there and start drying out your stuff. I mean, the main things you need to dry out are your boot liners and your gloves, you know.
Gosh.
And I do have like a tent outfit you would end up wearing for the rest of the trip. I remember one time pulling the wet jacket off with a big fur ruff around it and putting it inside the vestibule. And it was like a suit of armor. It was just like completely solid, had my body imprint, you know, inside it. It was pretty insane. Yeah. So a lot of the time you do want to try to swim across. I always didn't like that because the polar bears are good swimmers as well. So,
oh gosh.
And at one point in time, somebody has the gun on the sled as they were crossing. So it was always this, you know, sort of like, okay, I want the gun with me kind of thing. So yeah. So that's part of polar travel, you know, in the Arctic Ocean. And with and climate change is happening, there's less and less multi-year ice up there. I'm seeing more and more single year ice, which is not good because that'll usually melt at the end of the season in June and July, like right around now, which leaves less sea ice for the polar bear. And also what happens is that the ice creates this albedo, which means reflectivity. So when the sun hits the ice, it bounces up and cools our atmosphere. When you have dark saline seawater, which is basically the Arctic Ocean, that absorbs that heat and the sea will get warmer. It'll create more and more ice melt as well. So this is one of the main causes and an early warning sign for climate change, you know. So it's not a good thing. And I think we're all trying to do the right things to combat that. And I am a ambassador for Protect Our Winters. And also, you know, I do a lot of research for climate science up there, too, whether it's collecting snow data, ice thick measurements, isotopes, all kinds of stuff. So I work a lot with different scientists. And like I said, in 2005, earlier in the podcast, I designed some beacons I placed on the ice to track the ice up to 10 years and give scientists definitive data on where that ice was moving and also temperature and barometric pressure. So one of the more things that I'm proud of within this, you know, polar community is, you know, it wasn't about getting to, you know, the pole. It was really about how we can all help out mankind.
Fantastic. And we appreciate you doing that. And it is interesting you bring up that with the albedo and the reflectivity, because that's something I've been reading a lot about recently is the cryosphere, if you will, which is basically just means that the poles of our planet, which is a lot of white ice, snow, frozen sea, all that just reflects so much sunlight back into the universe, essentially, back into space. And as we lose that white ice and snow, more and more of that sunlight gets absorbed into the earth. And so that's changing things quickly as well.
Absolutely. That temperature variant will actually create what's called the Gulf Stream. So it's important not only for, you know, being down in Antarctica and up in the Arctic, but even our surf and all our other things that we're involved in, too. So a little bit of temperature difference is going to change the Gulf Stream quite a bit. So
definitely something to keep our eyes on. All right. How many days do you ski per year?
I think last year I got 135, I think.
And damn.
I'd say probably half were backcountry. I did a hut trip in Idaho, and I was doing a lot of the crowds in Tahoe sometime where, you know, something I wasn't really into. And I live over on the west shore of Lake Tahoe, North Lake Tahoe, and I have access to backcountry skiing right from my door. So it makes it really easy to go skiing, doing a lot of stuff on the West Shore skiing. And we have some great skiing here. And so, yeah, I didn't really do any trips. So I was doing a lot of skiing and certainly loving it. And, you know, sort of Squaw's our mountain where we go and ski, and certainly love being there. It's got some great skiing, and even some of the skiing there, we're doing some great side country stuff as well. So, yeah, I think I got 135 days, and my season got a little bit cut short even too. So, because of the heart injury.
You're dedicated, man. That's a lot of days, and especially end in April.
Not as many as you, my friend.
Well, I have mental issues around skiing.
You do, and you're amazing how you get after it.
Oh, thanks, man. One of my big motivations is you, man. So keep it going. What's your biggest accomplishment in skiing?
So I think my biggest accomplishment in skiing, I think I've actually been in like 5 or 6 Warren Miller movies, but I've been a snowboarder and a skier.
Warren Miller, you've skied and snowboarded.
Yeah. So that's sort of funny.
That is really cool. Well, I'll ask you a little bit about that again later. What's your biggest accomplishment in polar exploration? Well, or polar adventure, as you call it.
Well, I think we talked about that early. It's really just raising money for charity and all the charity work I've done, and also getting these handicapped people to the pole and to showcase that they're, they're doing amazing things, but they're not trying to have those, you know, handicapped people, whether you're blind or you're in a wheelchair, to go do a polar expedition. They just want you to get off the couch and go down and get a quart of milk, you know? So I think that is definitely by far my biggest accomplishment in that, you know, I could care less about, skiing to the poles, unless we're doing something really cool, like we're raising money for charity.
What's your biggest accomplishment in life?
That's a good one. I still don't know what I want to do and grow when I grow up, but I'm still working on it. And, you know, I think, you know, my sons, Tyree, Tan, you know, are probably a big part of my life, and watching them try to navigate through life has been, you know, really an interesting thing, and certainly enjoy that. And I look forward to seeing where they go. So that's, you know, probably my biggest accomplishment. I think I've had to make a lot of sacrifices in my life with my family for that. So, hopefully, they don't hold that against me.
I know they don't. How do you define yourself?
I don't know how I define myself. I think because I do a lot of different things. I just want to try to have more fun than everybody else. I think that's the bottom line. Yeah. And I like to take people to remote places and show them this amazing planet in which we live. And, you know, I have a nonprofit which is a youth educational nonprofit with the ISACS Foundation and Impact School. So that's something that I'm really, really proud of too. And COVID sort of made a big hit on us there. So I'm excited to try to get that back and rolling and start getting some youth to show them around this planet. So we'll see what happens.
I think one of your definitions could be Earth ambassador.
Okay. Yeah.
Where's your favorite place to ski?
You know, Antarctica is probably my favorite place to go skiing. My favorite mountain range is probably the Sierras. I do love the Alps, and, you know, I'm blown away. And I was lucky enough, two or three years ago, I was guiding Richard Branson on in the Alps in the summer. I'd never been there in the summer, and it was a fundraiser for the Strive Challenge, which was amazing, and met all kinds of super interesting people, and it was certainly a lot of fun. And ended up going, and Mont Blanc was the crescendo of that trip. So anyway, it was the Alps really turned me on. I really love the atmosphere and the lifestyle and the just the people. How they embrace the mountains there. I think it's a little bit different. I think it's more of a solo mission here in the Sierras, where, you know, me and, you know, a core group of friends will go down there and ski, you know, the classic couloirs, and just, there's so much skiing that's there that, and no one's ever there. So it's one of those things which is pretty special to me. And that's one of the reasons why I moved to Lake Tahoe, is really because the access to this Eastern Sierra is like unbelievable. And, you know, like, you can ski 11 months out of the year. So not a bad place to live.
Not a bad place to live at all. I've been telling myself for a long time, I'm going to do at least one or two seasons in the Alps before I turn 50. And that's coming up soon. Because okay. I agree. I love that. I love the culture out there. I love going to a refugio at 10,000 feet in Italy and having an amazing pizza and a spritzer. So there's not a lot. It's not a lot better than that.
I agree.
What would you do if you couldn't ski and guide?
I'm not sure. I've reinvented myself, you know, many times through my life. And, you know, I've always get bored, and I'm on sort of a next chapter, I think, right now. And I think I'm really into sailing and surfing, and those are things that I'm not very good at yet. So, you know, I like to do things well. So I think that's where I'm going to focus the next 10 years, is doing some sailing.
What scares you the most in the mountains?
I don't really have too many fears. I have a pretty sensible outlook, and I certainly don't have a death wish. And I walk away from mountains all the time we're blessed here, not to be complacent, but we're blessed here in the Sierras, where, you know, usually it's that Sierra cement, and it bonds real easily after 24 hours and that kind of thing. So, you know, if you're living in the Wasatch and you're living in Colorado, you have a lot more different problems that you're dealing with. And especially if you're taking clients out in the mountains too. So, you know, avalanches do a little bit. And, you know, I think just making the right decisions. I work with some really high end people. And one of the things that I really bum out about is some people, you know, that are in that 1% feel they really don't want to listen to anybody. And you say, ski to the left of my track, and they're off to the right of the track, and, you know, and not listen to anything you're saying. And it's just sort of a little bit frustrating. And it's not the easiest guiding either too. So, especially if you're in places like Antarctica, where there's crevasses everywhere, and it's, you got to really be on your game.
The human factor can be terrifying in the mountains. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah.
What do you love most in the mountains?
I love the freedom. I love the nature. I love the wind in my face. I think there's some freedom there. I think it's something that I feel really at peace with. You know, I feel, you know, when I'm one-on-one with the nature, I do a lot of solo stuff too. And I think it grounds me. It's my meditation. It's where I love to be. And I think that's where I'll continue to be, in the mountains, if I'm not on the water somewhere. The mountains are really someplace that I find comfort.
What's the funniest accident you've had in the mountains?
It actually didn't happen to me, but I think some of the funny, like, I, you know, our guide team, they're always playing practical jokes with the newbies. And so I think those are some of the funniest moments, to be honest with you. I think one of our mutual friends, Keoki Flag, I think Andrew McLean turned his black diamond skin clip the wrong way, you know, and he's usually trying to get all his camera gear together. And he's usually not always the first person out the door to get everything ready. So they sometimes call him a little bit of a junk show, but I don't. And I think we got over there, he was like, you know, didn't have all his stuff together, and, you know, his boots were unbuckled, and everybody else was waiting ready. And Andrew had previously, while his skins were drying on the boat, turned the skin clip around. And for the life of Keoki, he could not figure out how to turn his skin clip around. You know, he just, it wouldn't work, you know? And so he was like, what's this going on here? And he was like, he saw smoke coming from his ears, you know? And I remember witnessing that and just laughing. And, you know, we, at his expense, but, there's been some other funny moments with guides carrying, you know, really heavy rebar as snow wands up the mountain that are like, you know,
yeah,
10 feet tall, and a few of those type of situations that have been quite humorous. But we have, we always like to have a lot of fun, and we don't want anybody get hurt, of course. But at some of the new guys' expense, it's sort of like a orientation or somebody that's just coming in new.
Oh, it's so, like a little hazing, lighthearted. Yeah, like what's the scariest accident you've had in the mountains?
I've fallen into a couple crevasses up to my chest that were really deep, crossing the Antarctic, especially on the one with the Richard Dunwoody. So that was a little bit sketchy. I've had a few, concussions climbing mountains, ski accidents, knock on wood, nothing really that serious, but certainly some concussions. And that's probably it. I haven't had any serious, compound fractures or anything like that, knock on wood, but it's, I'm still getting up there. So I'm dialing it back a little bit.
Good, man. And that's the smart thing to do. What have been the most fear-inducing, biggest risk ventures of your life? And these don't have to be skiing and guiding. This can be anything.
I think starting a company and trying to step out. And, I think I've done a lot of that reinvention of myself, and it's always a risk. And I think I entertain that. I sort of work well with that. And, I'm good about putting things together. That's probably, there's always a little bit of fear in that, but I don't have too many fears. I think, if it fails, it fails. And, but I like to do things well and give it 110%. And so, who knows? I might be sailing next year, around the world. So we'll see. That's scary a little bit, but we've been on the Drake Passage on some pretty high seas. And sometimes that's, I was in a 45-foot boat with Skip Novak with Andrew McLean crossing the Drake Passage. And we had 30-foot swells, and that I didn't really even have time to be fearful about it, but I kept on looking over at Skip, and he's a world-class sailor that's, Whitbread round the world race. And he was reading Rin Tin Tin or something like that, and he's like, no big deal. And I just, made me feel comforted, but I was like, I don't think we're going to make this,
Whoa.
And so that was a big ocean scare me.
Yeah.
I'm humbled by the ocean and the power.
Myself as well, man. Crossing that Drake Passage with you has been quite spicy for me.
Yeah.
I ask everybody this one. This is more of a sad or dark question, but I think it's important for our listeners. How many friends have you lost in the mountains?
Oh, Miles. I can't even begin to think. It's like, it seems like every winter there's a friend or two that's a really good, close acquaintance or a great buddy that, ends up not making it, and, whatever that reason may be. And, I think I sort of look at it as I'm afraid not to live. I want to live my life the way I want to live it, and I want to enjoy it. I certainly, as a guide, you don't want to take unnecessary risks, and you want to make sure that you keep everybody safe. I want to live my life the way I want to live it. And certainly to be in the mountains, there's lots of risks that you have to take. And if you can mitigate those risks, I think you're doing the right thing. So I think sometimes people, let their guard down or not really using all the faculties that they have in front of them to be able to make the right decisions. And I think, within that, we lose friends, male, female, whatever. And whether it's a car accident or a cancer or something like that. But, we have lost a lot of friends in the mountains doing what they love doing. And, I lost a friend just 2 months ago, and he was crossing Greenland, and really good friend, and another international polar master guide and super skilled, probably one of the most skilled polar guides in the world. And he was coming down off, finished the trip, and was doing a south to north Greenland kite expedition, and he fell into a crevasse, And so, and I think, you do look at it and you think about it and are things going to change? No, I'm not going to change the way I look at anything. I mean, obviously we try to learn from his mistakes or whatever, look at what happened to try to figure that out. And that's always something that human nature wants to do is try to figure things out. and hopefully we don't make those mistakes again, you know? So, but he's an amazing guy and he's still with, you know, I'm still think about him every day and, you know, and unfortunately, I won't be saying hello to him when I get up to Svalbard this next year. So, or down in Antarctica, if we're doing a polar thing this year. So anyway.
Well, thank you for sharing. I'm so sorry that happened.
Yeah.
How many avalanches have you been in?
I've been in a lot of slough stuff where you get sloughed off and, you know, things could have been fairly serious. I was up in doing a TV show up in near Alyeska, Chugach Powder Guides.
In Alaska?
And I was guiding a couple clients and we were all the way down at the bottom at the fairly safe zone to get picked up. And what had eventually happened, a helicopter was going up, dropping off some other clients. And they had, it was early in the season and they had pretty substantial snowfall. And the helicopter blades, I think, caused this, you know, catastrophic, you know, event that happened. And I thought it might have been some skiers from above because there was definitely some time frame between when we got to the bottom and the next group was skiing down. And so I thought it would had to have been for sure skiers. And, you know, and I was like really worried about that, but it was actually the helicopter dropping them off. And we were all the way that at the bottom in a, I felt that was fairly safe place. And we had our skis off and we had them, you know, stacked and we were waiting there and the avalanche came down and I said, told everybody, let's start running. Cause running sideways. And we ended up getting semi buried, you know, no deaths or no injuries, but we lost some skis and I got buried pretty much up to my chest and was able to extract myself and and help everybody else out. But it just shows you, you know, you're like, you're someplace where you think there's no chance that there, this could ever happen. And it does, you know, so you just really have to stay on your toes and, you know, don't get complacent, you know, really try to, and even when I'm in Antarctica where there's tons of crevasses, I even carry a probe on my harness, you know, and I'm probing constantly to make sure that there's not snow bridges around. Cause if you went there later in March and you'd look around you, it's sort of like being on Denali, you know, you go up in May and you come back in June and you're like looking around like, oh my God, we skied over all this stuff. There's like huge holes everywhere. But that's how it was in, you know, and on the peninsula too. You go come down, you go in March and you see all the holes that are everywhere and a lot of the ramps get trashed too. So the access to some of the good skiing and the ramps are, you know, just go away. So
that's, that's great information. And I, in a way, I almost don't want to see where I've been skiing in Antarctica once it's melted out. Cause I know you guys always tell me this is all crevasses, but when we're there, the snowpack's pretty bomber. So that,
I agree, November.
So you've been on climbing and skiing trips all over the world. So if you had to pick a couple, maybe one or two, what was your favorite ski trip or your favorite climbing trip?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the camaraderie and the friendships that you make. I think, you know, some of the my most favorite trips, you know, are like ones like in Kashmir where the skiing was just all-star, you know, and then the people were all-star and the people, the culture and all everything blended really well. And I think Japan is a lot like that. You know, you can get some amazing skiing, amazing people, amazing culture. And when you have all those things line up, I think it becomes, you know, sort of a five-star ski trip. And that's really what Ice Axe is really trying to do. I do like skiing to wildlife, but that's sort of rare to be able to do, put trips where you're going to encounter, guarantee that you're going to encounter wildlife. And I think Antarctica and Svalbard are definitely ones that I can guarantee we're going to encounter wildlife. So that makes it pretty special for me. Yeah, I think those are, you know, Kashmir, probably, you know, the Antarctic trip every year is really something special that we have to do, which is that we don't have to do, but we do every year, which is super special. And I think you end up with 100 new friends. So
I agree. I mean, life is all about connection. When you have that community and that connection and you add that to the excitement and the endorphin levels that you get on an incredible ski or climbing trip, man, it's that, that's when it tops out. I agree.
And I think some of the, I think it's unique with the Ice Axe trip that, you know, you have 100 people that are all, you know, fired up and similar backgrounds and, you know, energy towards skiing. So I think that's what makes it, you know, ultimately special too, as well.
Is there anywhere you would not go back to?
You know, I did an 8,000 meter peak in 2003, and the snow conditions were terrible.
Which you one?
Choyu.
Okay. In the Himalaya.
Yeah. So I wouldn't go back to an 8,000 meter peak and try to ski it. It just wasn't that much fun for me. Spitting up blood and just like,
oh,
the skiing wasn't that good. I did like the culture and the, you know, the physical prowess of trying to attempt to do an 8,000 meter peak, which was good. But I think as the guide in me and in us, I would have difficulty walking by somebody that really was in trouble. You know, I don't think I would have to abandon my goals to try to help somebody else. And I think that happens a lot nowadays.
It really does. Absolutely. Where have you not skied, but you'd love to go ski there?
Iraq, Iran, the Altai are some of the places that I'd love to go ski. I haven't been to Kazakhstan. I mean, there's some Eastern Bloc countries that I haven't skied yet. So yeah, there's the world's out there, you know, and I think it's about setting goals and finding remote places with Google Earth and everything. You can really find some cool places to go to that not a lot of the people are going. And I think it might take a little bit of work to get there, but you know, I think the world's your oyster if you're really motivated and you really want to find some remote places to go and ski. I think they're out there.
What's your favorite ski movie of all time?
By far has to be Hot Dog.
Which is the Squaw Valley. It's almost a soft porn, but it's a great one. I love that one too. What challenges you the most intellectually on a daily basis?
Challenges me most, I guess, just relationships. I think that's part of, you know, being traveling a lot and being away a lot. So I think relationships with my kids or, you know, my personal relationships sometimes become a little bit difficult. So yeah, that's probably one of my biggest challenges. I think we just need to work on communication and really try to work on that to make it successful.
What's your favorite book or books?
I think one of my favorite books is The Rise to Superman by Stephen Kotler, who's actually a friend of mine.
Ah.
That's about the flow state, which is good. There's so many great books out there. I have like a amazing Polar library that I continue to build and work on and love reading about climbing and skiing. And, you know, I think I love to read. So that's always a lot of fun. And so there's always I have like 15 books on my side table right now that I'm reading all of them. So I need to pick one up and finish it.
I love it. I'm the same. I do all my books on tape now and I'm in the car. And so I just crank through books now. Because I do a lot of long drives across the desert between mountain ranges. And it's I highly recommend it if you haven't started that yet. I love it. Who has inspired you the most in your life?
I think by far it was Alex Lowe. And he was an early mentor of mine. And I think Alex just had this, you know, engaging energy and just nonstop fun, and he made every trip that I went on with him a blast. And if that was in, you know, Montana or wherever that was, he just had this really amazing energy. And I think, you know, I think he was one of my early inspirers to do what I do and to take people skiing to Antarctica. And, you know, and also Doug Coombs as well. I think he was another somebody I really looked up to, and you know, how he lived life, and, you know, he wanted life in the mountains and wanted to raise his kids in the mountains. And I think that was a lot, both those guys were a big influence on me.
And I think, you know, our listeners can listen to our podcast from last season with Andrew McLean to learn more about Alex Lowe as well. He and Andrew worked at Black Diamond together and sort of started the term Dawn Patrol, which is really interesting to learn about. Would you tell us more about your experience with Doug Coombs? Doug Coombs is a legendary free skier, ski mountaineer, Jackson Hole person who really pioneered a ton in our sport. And we have a lot to be grateful for, you know, that he did for us. And I'm curious about, what was your experience with Doug? How did you meet him? And what was your time with him like?
Well, it sort of happened by accident. I wouldn't say by accident, but I was a snowboarder in the late 80s. So I ended up going down to Doug's operation that he started in 1990. And he might've won the extreme comp, the first one that they had extreme ski competition. But I met him that year and started skiing with him, and liked his professionalism and how he handled it, because the other operators, there's only one other operator at the time, was not very professional. And I wanted to, I knew the dangers that were there because I was going to Chamonix, and I saw the how the guides took really great pride in safety and that. And I just didn't see it up in Valdez. So I ended up going with Doug, and we became sort of good friends. And he was going over to Le Grave as well, doing steep ski camps. But every year I would go up and hang out with him. And then we ended up connecting on some other stuff here in the States and doing some other climbs and, you know, up in the Pacific Northwest and doing stuff with Hood and Adams and Three Sisters and some other stuff in the early 90s. I was on foot on a snowboard. So I was doing that, and I wanted to put together the first ski and snowboard descent of the Vincent Massif in Antarctica.
Which is one of the seven summits.
Yes, it is. And so I asked Doug, and we put a strong team together, including Dirk Collins from TGR, Stephen Koch, Mark Newcomb, who is was a guide as well up in Alaska. And we put a strong team together, and we put that trip together in 1999. And interesting enough, it was probably, you know, the turning point where I really fell in love with Antarctica, you know. And so, you know, we had a great time, and we were stuck at every point, and we were there for weeks and weeks. And we just, all we wanted to do is ski, and just the energy and the compassion and the love of skiing was completely, you know, there. So I think that was one of the key elements that was just that really set me to do what I do and to start Ice Axe Expeditions was really that first trip to Antarctica. And I fell in love with Antarctica. I wanted to see more. I wanted to, 2 months later, I chartered a Russian research vessel and went down to the Antarctic Peninsula and pioneered skiing down there. And, you know, that was pretty late in the season for their season. I think it was probably end of February, beginning of March. So, you know, we always go down in November. So we found all kinds of great skiing. The scientists would go to shore and we would have all day to go skiing, and then we would just come back. And so that was sort of how I started, you know, my trips down there. And then I think 6 months later, I was guiding a blind guy and his sight guide who was deaf from the coast to the pole. So, it's baby steps, but it was, you know, something that was really fascinating to me. And, you know, and I think Doug was a great mentor as far as skills and mountain sense and just the love of the mountains and the love of skiing. And I think, that's how that relationship blossomed.
That is such a cool feather in your cap that you have the first descent of Mount Vincent, 16,000 foot Mount Vincent in Antarctica, which is a seven summit. And you got to do it with Doug Coombs. That is so cool, man. That is an experience many people would love to be a part of. Well, that was the rapid fire round, which was not so rapid, but that was awesome, Doug. Thank you. Those are great, great, great stories. That's what it's all about here, I think, on the podcast, is getting great stories.
Today's Snowbrains podcast is brought to you by Alta. With an 84-year history, Alta is a place that is steeped in history and tradition. We're not talking about your grandfather's or grandmother's mothball-y ski sweater tradition. We're talking about the birthplace of avalanche research in North America kind of tradition. Alta is a place where the five independent lodges still offer the tradition of family-style dinners and ski bars that generations of skiers have frequented. Today's Snowbrains podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Skip the lift lines this year and get into the backcountry. With the all-new Scott Winter Essentials, you're set to have a safe and fun time in the mountains. Check out their new product line at scottsports.com.
But we have to start with asking you about your polar exploration, because I think what the listeners want to know is, how the hell did you get into this? You know, how did the polar exploration start? Was it that Vincent trip, that going to Mount Vincent? What got you into this polar exploration, going to the North Pole, going to the South Pole, more times than anybody else on Earth?
Yeah, skiing was my love. And I think it sort of happened by accident. I had an opportunity, and I think I just mentioned it. It was like I did the, you know, Vincent trip, and then I ended up doing some a peninsula trip, and then had an opportunity to try this polar thing, something I'd never, ever done before. I mean, I'd done winter camping, but I had to not only figure out how I was going to do it myself, train, you know, properly, and also how was I going to get this blind guy? across. And so I had all kinds of ideas with bells on the back of my sled. And, you know, I'd done a lot of reading, and there's a couple people I had mentors that I worked with to be able to go and do that. But I was really way out of my comfort zone. But sometimes that's what you have to do. You dive in, you know, with 2 feet, and, you know, it's really about planning and preparation for those trips. And really, if you plan really properly and you have a lot of preparation involved in that, you can really be successful. And I think that goes on with really anything that you do, whether you're trying to run a company or you're trying to get to the pole. It's one of those things that you, you know, the planning and preparation leads to success. So that was my first polar trip. It was a full on crossing from the coast to the pole. I'd never done a last degree. Yeah. I'd never done any of that. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot about myself. It's a lot of time of just being alone. And even though you're with other people, a lot of introspective thought, which is really fascinating. And, you know, I think it becomes a very simple way of life. And you really have to just focus on getting your miles in. And really, you know, I had so many great ideas on that first trip. I mean, if you look at my journal, I have you know, I think about 180 pages of notes. Wow. You know, and half of them I couldn't even remember, because at the end of the day, I would try to jot them all down and half of them I couldn't remember. So I wish I just had some sort of tape recorder that I could keep up with all the ideas I had, because it was really fascinating to me, the amount of time for that introspective thought. But yeah, it was that was 787 miles in 62 days. Wow. So it wasn't a short trip.
And I guess it just keeps crossing my mind. How cold does it get? What was your coldest day?
I think the coldest temperature I experienced was in the interior of Antarctica with wind chill. I think it was minus 72. I think minus,
holy shit.
The mean temp was minus 58. And I think the wind chill was minus 72. And I was with Chris Erickson and Bean Bowers. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a crazy climber, you know, from El Chalten, and lived in Montana as well. And I had a couple of guides, and we were guiding this South Pole marathon, and Whoa. we were actually on snowmobiles, so it was even colder because you weren't moving at all. Oh. And there was several of the runners got hyperthermic. It wasn't really a race. It was more of every mile I had a big sled behind my snowmobile, and they could put their down jackets on and have a cup of tea and hot chocolate and, you know, soup, and then they would run another mile, and we, you know, I'd have stuff for them. So but anyway, that was a pretty amazing trip that they were able to cross 26.2 miles from a linear course to the South Pole. And then some of them wanted to continue running like an ultra. All that meant was them running back to a cone, you know, a couple miles and then back to the finish line again. But, you know, there was a few people that really shouldn't have been doing it, and they did anyway because they wanted to. And I think that minus 72 started to approach, and it was probably one of the coldest temperatures I've ever experienced. And you really have to be organized. I mean, everything was just frozen.
That's intense. So let's shift gears here. You know, we talk about all this polar exploration, high mountain climbs, you know, all this stuff that you do in Antarctica. You are also a professional soccer player, which is just feels so removed from that. But I know for you, it's not. And so I'd love to learn a little more.
Yeah, I think soccer was a great foundation for me. I mean, an outlet as a kid. It really, I wanted to do things well. So I spent a lot of time training, and I think it set up the groundwork for me and later in my life for all the other things I wanted to do, because I wanted to do them well. And it just showed the dedication that was necessary to do things right. I wasn't the smartest kid in the class. I wasn't the best athlete, but if I put the time and energy into that, I think I could be halfway decent. And I think it was a time frame where it wasn't that popular, you know, soccer wasn't that popular. I mean, I ended up going out to LA and playing for a team in Manhattan Beach. And so that was sort of something that I'm proud of and certainly loved doing it. I wasn't certainly making any money, but it was something that I wanted to continue to do as a passion project in life. And I was certainly doing other things at the time as well. I was doing some, you know, modeling in front of the camera, doing commercial work. And I think that helped me too, because I could juggle the soccer ball and say my name on camera and be able to do some soccer commercials right before the World Cup came out. So that was sort of one of the ways I segued into, you know, making money and just sort of living life by my rules. You know, I didn't have an office. I didn't have that. So, you know, it was something that was, you know, the soccer was something that I loved doing in college and was pretty good in college. And then moved
West
on
Virginia,
to,
right?
Yes, sir. Continue. So West Virginia University is where I went to school. And I think my sophomore year, we ended up getting ninth in the nation, Division One. So we had a pretty strong team of a bunch of foreigners and certainly loved playing there and having a good time, you know, playing soccer. And just, I think university was a lot of fun for me. I wasn't the best student because I was more concentrated on girls and alcohol and having a great time and then making sure that I was playing soccer as well. So that was a lot of fun. And certainly wanted to continue playing that game, playing the game that I loved. And, you know, was able to do it for a few more years after that. And it was something that I loved doing. And yeah.
Very cool, man. Well, and I love that it led to modeling and doing some stuff on TV. And, you know, everybody always talks about how you did some kind of American Gladiator type show, but I've never actually confronted you about this. So tell me what this is. I have no context at all except for that.
Well, I think, you know, as when you have an agency, they're always in, basically LA is a very commercial oriented, like a lot of commercials are shot there. So
right,
I was going out on a lot of commercials. It wasn't like I was doing runway and, you know, print stuff or, you know, fashion magazines or anything. It was more about, okay, that we need a guy that can paddle, can windsurf or kiteboard or can juggle a soccer ball or ride a mountain bike or run. Or, you know, I was the action guy. I was the guy diving in the sand 700 times to pretend he was like a pro volleyball player on the beach. And I was that guy. I wasn't the guy at the end of the day with the sunset and the girl. I was like the action guy that was always out there. So I certainly loved doing that. It was always a lot of fun. And sort of segued into going out on a lot of castings, whatever that was it, whether it was a movie, a commercial, you know, or a TV show. And that was one of the things that was sort of the beginning of reality TV. And this was, I think 1999, right when I started my polo career. I think I did this show called Battle Dome, which was they rented the sport arena where the Clippers used to play, and they had all these events going on there, and it was like real deal. You had to like wrestle and grapple and fight like other steroided guys, and then they'd have like a commercial break, and then there would be like each of these guys, the steroided guys, had like a female companion, whether it was the Dom triplets or just some girl that was in a tight skirt and, you know, tight shirt. And they would sort of accompany them to the event where I was Malibu Doug and I would like have to fight the country guy. And then he had a country girl with him too. And so you had to like, I think one of the events was like aerial kickboxing where you had like this sort of a scaffolding rig that got raised in the air and you had to like, and it did gimbal back and forth. So sometimes you had the advantage and sometimes you had the disadvantage, but you could like cruise down on the scaffolding ring and then you had to kick the guy or punch the guy off. I end up breaking the guy's arm.
Whoa.
I jumped down and I won the event, and downtown Julie Brown from MTV comes up to you and says, "Oh, Doug, you're Mr. You know," and I was like, "Oh my God, the guy hurt himself. You know, that's terrible." And she's like, "Oh, you're Mr. Nice Guy." And I was like, "No, it's just like, I didn't want to hurt anybody." You know, it was like crazy. So I end up going through a series of weeks of winning my rounds.
So you were a contestant, essentially.
I was a contestant.
Okay.
Malibu Doug was the contestant.
Malibu Doug.
Yeah. And so I won the first round, and then I think I won another round, and then I was in the semifinal and I won that. And then I was in the final and I had to wrestle. This guy was like an Olympic wrestler. And, you know, if you were in Vegas, I wouldn't be betting on me because this guy can just like, you know, has no problem. And the event was that we had, an elevated stage. Okay. It was like a round stage. And then all the people that were kicking your ass were like above you, like watching in on this, you know, down on you. Uh-huh. And so it was really bad television because there was no way for me to like beat this guy. So I was trying to think of tactics that I could use to beat him. And the only thing I could think of is, you know, when we started wrestling, I would just run into him and sort of just bear hug him. you know, okay. and I wouldn't let go. Okay. And then we would roll around the, you know, this elevated stage a bunch of times, and then we'd fall off. And that happened for like 45 minutes. You know,
I was like,
this is the only way I can like try. I'm just going to try to tire him out. And then that's what I did. Cause, you know, we crawled back up on the stage and, you know, and we said, battled him, and we started, you know, doing again. I stepped aside and I threw him off the elevated, mat and end up winning the whole thing.
I didn't know this story. I love it.
Yeah. So I am Battle Dome champion of the world. And I have a big like Super Bowl ring to prove it too. And,
you
could probably find it as well on TV somewhere.
What did your professional soccer and your college soccer and your crazy experiences in LA, how did that translate into the rest of your life? What advantages did that give you?
Well, it really gave me freedom. You know, it gave me freedom to just go explore this beautiful planet. And I think also the soccer was always a dedication. You know, you need to train, you need to be, you know, to put your time in to be able to be, you know, good at certain things. So I think that was part of it. Yeah, just the discipline. Exactly. And I think, you know, I had a very easy life. You know, it was like money came to me. I didn't really have too many worries in the world. I didn't own a house at the time. I was like, I was really just loving life. You know, I was like, going from, you know, one job to the next, and then I could take 6 months off and go, you know, to Bali or go to, you know, New Zealand and Australia and go climb and ski and snowboard, you know? So it was a lifestyle that I really dreamed about, and I was just having fun and probably trying to have more fun than everybody else, which I still try to do. So I think that the LA thing was good. I didn't really like the people that much. There was a lot of, just not real people, I think, and probably the circle that I was hanging out with. So I was spending a lot of time when I was there up in the mountains in the Sierras. Also, and, you know, got into climbing a lot and was going out to Joshua Tree and Talkeets, and I climbed Gorgonio and San Jacinto and Baldy, and I do those like 3 or 4 times a year, and, you know, just run up those and the U Notch and the V Notch and Palisades Glacier. And so I was doing a lot of stuff, and also going up to Mammoth as well. So it was like that. I wanted to get out of LA as much as possible. So fast forward to when I set my company up, I ended up moving to Lake Tahoe and building a big house and starting the company here is where I you know, came here in 2000. So that's why I moved here and really, really never looked back. I don't really intend to go back to a big city anywhere. I like living here and fortunate enough to be able to survive and live up here, because it's, you know, it's become an issue with just overpopulating and, you know, everybody moved here from the pandemic. So it's been a little bit different, but anyway.
Very cool transition. And, so, and then how long was your time in LA?
I was there for about 15 years. Yeah, pretty much my whole adult life has been in California, you know, 15 years and then 22 up here. So I have to think that California has been my home.
Absolutely. So let's talk about your mountaineering a little bit here. So you've climbed Denali, Kilimanjaro in Africa, Mount Kenya in Africa, 22,000 foot Ama de Blom in the Himalaya, 23,000 foot Aconcagua in Argentina, 8,000 meter peak Choyu, which is 26,000 feet. So which of these high mountains that you've climbed was the most challenging for you? And it sounds like you referred to Choyu earlier, but I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, well, I think Choyu, any 8,000 meter peak, they say that's one of the easier ones to ski anyway.
Right.
But I think any 8,000 meter peak is going to be difficult. You know, it's like, but it's really, you know, you surround yourself, and I didn't have like a guide or a team. I did go on a permit from IMG, but we were like, after we left Advanced Base Camp, we were on our own, that's how I like to do it, you know? And I was asked to go to a bunch of other, like, I think Gashbrum 1 and 2 to go ski with. And I didn't really enjoy it. And the 8,000 meter peak wasn't something that I really wanted to go pursue. I think it really wasn't great skiing. I enjoyed the pursuit of it. It was fun and going there, but it felt contrived, because the only sponsors that wanted you to go to do these you know, huge peaks that really didn't make a lot of sense. And when there was like so many peaks in the Karakoram and around these huge mountains that had never been climbed, skied, and there were 6,000 meters or there were, you know, 6,500 meters. And that interested me. You know, it wasn't like you fall, you die. It was like these beautiful pyramid ramps that were endless, you know, with 7,000 foot faces. And that was something that I really, you know, caught my eye and wanted to go do. So I think that's sort of where how my career sort of shifted. And, you know, I moved, you know, I was going to Chamonix every winter and being up in Alaska for, you know, a month every winter too, or every spring. And I think that was, you know, a big part of my transition into that is really like, hey, let's go find some stuff that's not, you know, an 8,000 meter peak where it's like, okay, that's the only money you're going to get sponsored for. But it was never really about money for me. It was all more about passion and doing the things I love doing. So.
Absolutely. Any funny stories from any of your mountain climbing expeditions?
Well, we went down to Antarctica and we had funny names for some of the pioneering ski descents. There was one called Sex Troll. That's on Winky Island. And there was a female tourist on that trip that was from England. And she was always going up to, you know, all the people that all the guides that I was with, or they were actually just participants, but they're all like guides in their own right. And she was like asking them if they want to shag. And we got a little bit lit one night. And so I think we ended up calling, we were so hungover, and we went on this beautiful peak that sort of had a mushroom cap on top of it. And it was just like, I think Chris Erickson got some amazing photos on that peak. And it was just super challenging and super fun and beautiful day, like amazing day on the peninsula. And I think we called it Sex Troll. So it's funny how you come up with these names for some of these pioneering some of these peaks. And that one will always stick out.
Absolutely. And Wenke Island was such fun skiing last time we were down there. I love that spot. I think it's one of my favorites. Any scary stories from your high mountain climbing experience?
Well, yeah, Greiber got cardiopulmonary edema at Camp 3 on Shoreview. Oh. So we had to bring him down and put him in a gamma bag. And, you know, that's when you see your climbing partners in a really bad place. I think that's always sort of, you rethink stuff. And, you know, it was, And Russell Bryce was amazing. You know, he came up with oxygen and medicine camp 2, I think. But with the teamwork, we all got him down. And that's always not, you know, really pleasurable to see your buddies, you know, not do well on the mountains and almost die. So, yeah, that was scary. I think I mentioned my story about crossing Antarctica and falling into 4 different crevasses up to my chest. And that's, you know, and I didn't have any ropes or anything. I mean, the rope wouldn't have done anything. It was 150 feet deep. So a rope wouldn't even been, I had a plan with this, with Richard. And I said, if I disappear, just turn around and go back. You know, I was like, don't even come and look.
Right.
You know, I said, here's the sat phone. You have the sat phone. I'm going to scout. I'll come back and get you. And then we'll go, you know? And so that was pretty hairy and
heavy.
You know, been in some bad weather before, but I think there's no real bad weather. It's just bad clothing.
That's good. You got to start your own company on that one.
Yeah.
You know, I've experienced that as well. I had a client get high altitude pulmonary edema. I was guiding by myself independently on El Pico de Orizaba in Mexico. We were at about 15,000 feet when it happened. And oh my gosh, let's talk about breakthrough moments. So many of us in our lives and careers have these really powerful breakthrough moments, kind of moments of clarity, moments where it feels like the screen gets lifted and you can see the light and you can see what you truly want and where you want to go and how to get there. Have you had any of these kind of breakthrough moments in your life?
I've gotten some awards for some of the climate stuff that I've been doing, which is really sort of, you know, I'm proud of, you know, raising money for charity is a breakthrough moment, but, you know, I honestly don't know what I want to do. I get bored easy. I want to continue to push not only the limits of what I'm capable of, but I still have ideas and places I want to go and explore. So I don't know if I can pinpoint these breakthrough moments. Obviously, you know, having kids and you know, marriage and stuff like that is always a great things in your life that you really look back on, and, you know, and also, you know, the failures too, as well. I think they, hopefully you learn from those failures and you become a better person and a better human. So that's a lot of it as well. And I think, you know, you continue to learn and be a better human and evolve as a human. And I think that's my goal in life, you know? And, so I can't really, there's, you know, yeah, I went to, you know, Alaska and that was seemed like a sort of starting block. And then I did Antarctica and then I got asked to do the polar thing, the polar crossing. So those were certainly breakthrough moments because I, you know, never probably would have, I was in the right place at the right time, but I feel like I've been in the right place at the right time all my life, you know? And I think that some of that's kismet and some of it's just being, you know, passionate about what I like to do.
That's a fantastic answer. And I'm excited that you've got all this curiosity around the ocean now, because the ocean is a huge passion of mine. If I'm not in the mountains, I don't even mountain bike. I don't even own a bicycle. If I'm not skiing, if it's not winter in the mountains, I'm directly to the beach and into the ocean. Yeah. It is, man, the ocean just attracts me like a moth to a flame, man. So let's jump into the Warren Miller a little bit. So okay. Warren Miller is you've been featured in and you've guided for you know, quite a few Warren Miller movies, and they're the most watched ski and snowboard movies on earth. So tell us a little bit more. What was it like working with Warren Miller, and you know, what was your role and what did you see and learn out there?
I think I love working with film crews, not only Warren Miller, TGR, or whoever that looks like, but you know, Tom Day is a good friend of mine. I think we've been on maybe, you know, 15 to 20 different expeditions together around the world, sailboats for 50 days or whatever, but he's a special human and I love being with him. And I think that
he's amazing.
That I was able to put some trips together that he was involved in. And I'm more into taking like skiers to these exotic spots, like whether it's Greenland or Svalbard or Antarctica. So I was lucky enough to put some segments in there, and some of them I'm skiing in, some I'm just guiding in, but it was, there's amazing people that I get to work with. And certainly the professionals of the elite professionals, which is just something that I pinch myself every day that I'm able to be around those type of people.
So skiing for you is something you've been doing since you were very young. Is that right? When did you start skiing?
Yeah, I think I was probably 7. I had a pair of Head Wahoos, not Yahoos, but Wahoos. They were the coolest thing, you know, and I had some Tyrolia bindings and I had a season's pass at Round Top, and it was, you know, it was like a lot of fun. I was playing hockey at the time. And of course I was playing soccer too, on traveling team. So it was, you know, our winter sport, and our winters weren't very long. So we only had a couple months to be able to ski, but I certainly love skiing. And I started traveling up to Vermont and, you know, Killington and Stratton and all the other resorts up in New Hampshire and Maine. And so I did a lot of skiing up in the Northeast. I think when snowboarding came out sort of, I want to say the mid 80s, I graduated high school in early 80s, so 82, and then I went to college from 82 to 86. So I started snowboarding, I think, right when snowboarding came out. And I remember being at Midvale, and there was one other guy that had a snowboard at Midvale. And I remember saying, like, I remember walking in and he was walking out. And he was walking to a snowboard, and I was going to put my snowboard next to his. And I said, dude, I got one of those too. It was like, it was such a rarity, you know, and we were always getting looks on the lift line because all the skiers didn't like us because they thought we were ruining the, you know, the moguls, or we're ruining the moguls, or we're out of control, or we're going to hit somebody. So that was a little bit of a, you know, getting try to adapt to that. But, and then I got more into, you know, more snowboard mountaineering. I think that's Alaska really led to that, and going over Europe where you're ice climbing stuff with a board on your back and you're like, how are we going to get down? And then you're rappelling, you know, your run that you're doing. I mean, I think I did the Cosmique the first time in like, I think 86. And it was like, what? We're going up the Grand Monte, and then you walk out and you have to rappel 60 feet to start the run. I was like, Jesus, you know, it's like, luckily I, my underwear was tight, you know? So it was like, amazing experiences to be able to do that and actually snowboard some of the classics over there was just sort of like, you know, legendary. Luckily they had great conditions to be able to do it. It was something that I'll never forget, to try to hone your skills, you know, with tools. And, you know, I remember even getting out of my snowboard and putting a crampon on one foot and down climbing with a board's edge and a crampon and two tools. You know, so, but I felt really comfortable with it, you know, almost more comfortable than I would on my more normal feet. So it was something that I didn't, you know, that I learned and progressed and certainly enjoyed.
I skied the Cosmiques, God, I think it was 2010, a long time ago now, with Hank DeVray from Squaw.
Oh, awesome.
And it was terrifying. It was very firm. I had to rappel in the top 50 feet or whatever, too. And I was thinking about that. I was like, God, if I was on a snowboard right now with one edge, I would just hike back out. I mean, I was very impressed. If anybody snowboarded it that particular day, too, it was, God damn. Yeah. A French guy passed us, no ropes. Yeah. Kicking rocks down on me. It was crazy.
Oh,
and when we told him to stop, like, hold, stop, stop, stop. You're kicking rocks. This is dangerous. He said, no, I cannot be delayed. It's like, I think he had to get to work or something, man. He was like a rocket out of there. I was really taking it slow. So let's jump into body and fitness really quick. So you're 57 now. How's your body holding up?
Pretty good. Knock on wood. You know, I've been very lucky. Obviously I had a heart attack, recently within 4 or 5 months ago. And, you know, I feel like 85%, you know, back to normal. I want to try to get 120%. So I'm starting to train a lot more, trying to get my heart rate up. I feel really strong, you know, it's just going to take a little bit of time. I'm hoping that I'll be 120%. And I got two new arteries that are completely clear now. So, and I'm trying to find, navigate and try to find with the people that I'm working with to try to find food allergies and what caused the actual hereditary inflammation. So I'm on the right track. I think some of the old school cardiologists are sort of like, take these pills, and I'm really trying to get off those. Those haven't been really great with me. It's really about food, you know, and how you eat and what you eat and what you're allergic to. So, or at least causes inflammation. So I think that's a big part of it. I'm feeling super strong. I'm working with a couple really great people, whether it's the company EOS, which is, they do a lot of mega yachts down in Antarctica, and I do all the skiing for them in Greenland as well. And they do other trips around the world too. So I've been working with them. I work with a guy named Bodie Miller, and he works with a company called Crossin. I'm not only doing trips with him, but we're also building some skis, trying to build some awesome skis. He's building all the carving skis. I'm working on the touring and the lightweight touring, and also the powder skis. So it's sort of a new front for me. That's exciting and interesting and, you know, innovative. And I love working with super smart people, and he's one of the smartest guys I know in the ski industry. So it's a lot of fun learning and working on stuff and making, you know, adjustments and trying to make the best ski on the planet.
And do you do any sort of strict training, like in a gym, or, you know, just body fitness that you would do at home? Or is most of what you do outdoors activities, out there having fun for your training?
Yeah, I do. I used to go to the gym a little bit, and I do have like a Peloton bike because I was using that during COVID just to train. To be honest with you, you know, I'm doing different things all the time, whether it's a polar trip or a ski trip or, you know, paddle trip or something like that. So it's the sport specific training is the most beneficial. So if I have a polar trip, I'm pulling tires up Squaw, you know, for 4 to 5 hours. Sometimes I'm busy. Whoa. All day. So I start at 11 o'clock at night and I put a headlamp on and I finish around three. You know, it's really trying to build that endurance and build that and simulate that same activity that you're going to be doing. Whether it's if you're ski touring, then, you know, and you don't have time to go outside, then you get on a Nordic track and you actually put a heavy pack on or whatever your pack might weigh. So there's ways to simulate the same activity that you're going to be doing to prepare yourself for these certain events. And I think that's been the most productive for me. Obviously, I work on core. I do yoga, a lot of stretching. Not enough stretching, but I think it's a very, very, very important. I've been doing a lot of yoga this summer. So that's been, you know, beneficial for my longevity. You know, I haven't had a lot of serious injuries other than some concussions and, you know, a few things here and there, but I've been really, really lucky other than this heart attack thing. And I feel like I caught that in time where I can still perform at an optimal level for the rest of my life. So yeah, I mean, injuries always happen, I think, with athletes and pushing it and trying to overdo too much. I think that happens. And, you know, I think you have to take care of yourself. I do a lot of nutrition and, you know, protein and, you know, I try to eat well and try to get body work done. And I think all the normal things that most athletes do, I think certainly helps. So I'll continue that path and, you know, and it's certainly you need to take care of yourself.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. Because yeah, I think people are always curious how these elite people do what they do. And I think the sports specific training is the right move. Let's shift gears to climate change. So climate change is really close to your heart. You're a Protect Our Winners athlete, and you know, you've been a lot of places where climate change is really visible. So I'd like to hear from you, what evidence of climate change have you seen in your life?
Yeah, I touched on it briefly earlier. I mean, the Arctic Ocean is truly an early warning sign, and I saw it, you know, in the early 2000s when climate change wasn't even really, you know, a thing. You know, I think they called it global warming back then. And, right. You know, I met some, you know, key people like Al Gore and someone like that. But, you know, wow. I saw it happening firsthand. You know, I was doing visual observations of watching the ice get less and less every year because I was going up to the Arctic. And even I pioneered all the skiing in Svalbard for the last 20 years. And 20 years ago, if you said, hey, I'm going to run trips all month of May on sailboats, I thought I'd be crazy because there was right. always the ice was always in the fjords and you wouldn't be able to even get in the fjords. So it'd right. be something that you couldn't even do. And right. so, you know, for the last 12 years, they haven't had ice in any of the fjords. So
in May,
in May. So, I mean, you could probably even run trips in April. And before I would even was questioning running trips in May. Wow. Or at least till the end of May. And so things have changed. You know, I'm seeing it a lot in Greenland. You know, Greenland's a big early warning sign too. There's all the glaciers are calving at an alarming rate. Antarctica, I'm seeing a little bit different. The water temp is changing a little bit and changing the acidification. The food source, which is krill, is moving. And penguins always go back to the same place. A lot of people don't know that. They go back to the same place to breed. And they also stay with most of the ones that I encounter on the peninsula there. They mate for life. So I'm seeing actually penguins move location mainly because of the food source. And so that's something that, you know, I'm witnessing, but, you know, like I'm in the interior of Antarctica. It's minus, you know, 36 instead of minus 40. So it's still freaking cold. You know, it's like, I can't, you know, and that's, we've had some warm days. I've had a day where I think it was minus 7 at the pole and that's unheard of.
Wow. You know?
I think that was like a record, you know, that the people at the pole were telling me that they've never had that warm a temperature that time of year, you know. And this we're talking about January, you know, that's the warmest time, but never below like 120, maybe in the, you know, minus 15 or something. But then they're also getting temperatures that are, you know, minus 60 too. So it's like they're getting extremes, you know. Anyway, so yes, I've witnessed a lot of climate change. You know, some of the places, even Tahoe, you see, you know, the bark beetle devastating a lot of during the drought years, where you're probably going to see a lot in the next couple of years because we have a drought this year and the bark beetle will just take over. We're seeing that. We're seeing low snow years like this one, but we're also seeing big snows as well. And we're seeing wetter and lower elevation or higher elevation rain, you know? So, you know, now we used to always get snow at, you know, the base of a squall. Now we get rain, you know, and the snow line has moved up to like 7,000 feet when it used to be 5,000. So all these are indications of climate change and it's definitely there. And I'm a Protect Our Winners ambassador. Also, I'm an ambassador for Plastic Pollution Coalition, which is, you know, mainly trying to eliminate single-use plastic. They do have some ocean initiatives like, you know, straws and all that kind of stuff too, like eliminate straws. But, you know, it's something that I'm passionate about. Even all my trips are plastic free and I've gotten Quark, a company I work with and we work with to do more environmental stuff and build programs around that too and become more environmentally friendly. And, you know, luckily the whole industry is moving in that direction too. But it's something that I've been observing. I work with scientists too to collect data. And I think that's really important as an adventurer to help scientists figure out more about it. And I think that was key in 2005 when I designed those beacons. You know, I had a standing ovation at a climate change convention in Oslo, Norway for the data that I brought back, you know, and I'm super proud of that. You know, it's awesome to be able to do that.
That's fantastic. And what do you think has to happen to see real change in the fight against climate change? Do you think it's more local, you know, people need to do their part, or do you think it's more broader, like government issued?
Well, it's both. It's both. I mean, it starts, you know, grassroots because our governments weren't taking the necessary initiative. So it has to come from the governments too. I think they're one of the biggest polluters. But you know, you got China, you got India that are polluting at an alarming rate, even though they're trying to change that. But you know, it's going to take, you know, we just need carbon sequestration is probably, you know, a great way to do it, you know, and whether we're building, you know, sequestering carbon collection machines, or we're building seaweed and kelp bed forests that are actually putting out CO2. So there's different ways to go about it. And I think trying to, you know, we're pretty smart, you know, humans. So we can come up with ways with technology and everything to do this, but we have to start now. And I think that was sort of the Paris Accord, you know, 15 years ago. So we need to get on it, and everybody has to do their part. And you know, I think you see it even with all the electric vehicles moving around too, but we also need to mine all the battery stuff too, to make sure it happens. So there's, it comes up with other problems. Even Lake Tahoe, where we live right now, or where I live, there's been some acidification that's happening and changing the clarity of the water, you know, and what is that from? Is it from the air? Is it from, you know, the streams putting polluting, you know, that run off into it? It's probably a little bit of both, you know, so... you know, we need to do our best to try to keep this planet the way it is. It's, we only have one.
We only have one. There is no planet B. I actually get a little frustrated with people planning on moving to Mars and the space exploration and all that stuff, because I love space, but it's always going to be easier and it's always going to be cheaper to fix Earth and or just treat Earth well in the first place.
Yeah.
So exactly. I almost just can't, I can't even handle those arguments. So. Yeah. Let's talk about COVID for a second, because COVID is, it's impacting us all. It's impacting this industry in an enormous way, skiing, guiding, everything. It's been a wild ride the last two ski seasons. I don't think anybody would argue that. So I'm curious, how has COVID affected you and changed your life? And have you found any positives during this pandemic?
Yeah, I think, well, obviously, you know, my company is does international travel. So there hasn't been any trips. So we tried to do one to Morocco that ended up being a disaster, but you know, we've been doing some domestic stuff, but basically Ice Axe has been non-existent, you know, we have had no trips, but it's been healthy for me. I've been able to concentrate on other projects and be more evolve as a better human. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of skiing. You know, like I said, during the first part of COVID, we had a big storm in April in Tahoe, and I was skiing every day, even though all the resorts were closed. And it was awesome.
It was good.
It was really good. And I was having a great time. And then when summer hit, I started paddling a lot. I think I was here all summer, which was like the first time that I haven't been like traveling around to different parts of the US or the world in the summer. I usually was going to Spain. So I didn't go there. I was home pretty much by myself for the whole summer, which was really interesting. And a lot of that introspective thought was like, oh, should I pivot? What should I do? What's my next step in life? And, you know, I think that gives you some groundingness to really just stop and really think and see where you want to go and what you want to do in life and who you want to be. And I think that helped out a lot.
Doug, that's all I got for you, man. I hugely appreciate you being on the show. Do you have any other thoughts, ideas, comments you'd like to share here at the end of the show?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, first of all, if you ever want to go skiing to Antarctica or some other remote places, you know, give Miles a call, you know, contact Snowbrains, because they can certainly get you to some interesting places. We concentrate a lot on Antarctica, and you ever thought about going to ski the seven continents, one of those places to go. And I think we would love to take you there. And I think it's one of these trip of a lifetime type things. So you can start saving your money, but we go every November. We do Svalbard. We do two different boats up in Svalbard every May. We're doing Greenland and Iceland and other places. You can always go to Kashmir or Morocco and want to ski the seventh continent. You know, after you've done Antarctica, we'll take you there too. And we're always building new and adventurous trips. So if you ever want to think about going someplace unique, you know, give Miles a call and we'll be glad to take you.
Let's do it. I love it, man. My, you know, Doug, you changed my life. You know, getting to go on these trips to Antarctica, getting to go to these trips to Svalbard, and just the time I've gotten to spend with you and all the incredible guides that you guys have on your team.
And we're going to do it again this November. Everything's looking positive that it's going to happen. Argentinian government just approved that they were approving Antarctic tourism this season. They did a big push down in Ushuaia, which is our disembarkation city, to try to COVID every citizen down there. So it's looking more and more likely that it's going to happen. So I'm really pleased about that, because I really want to try to pull this off and see that we can get down to Antarctica again this season. And I look forward to it. And I work with some amazing people and super happy to surround myself by some amazing humans, which makes me look great. So I think that's been my secret as well.
It's a good secret, man. And some of my favorite skiing is in Ushuaia, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree.
Doug, it was great talking to you today. I hugely appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here. Have a great day, man.
Awesome, buddy.
Thank you so much for listening to the Snow Brains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snow Brains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snow Brains.
Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Alta. Alta's opening day is set for November 20th, conditions permitting. We'll see you out there. And as Alta skiers like to say, come for the skiing, stay for the skiing. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Looking to test the boundaries but fearful of high-risk situations? Scott Sports knows that danger. That's why they've developed the Patrol E1 Avalanche Backpack, which is actually the backpack that I personally use in the backcountry. It's the ultimate free skiing avalanche backpack, pushing the boundaries of innovation. The supercapacitor technology, along with exceptional design, results in one of the lightest electric airbag backpacks on the market to date. To learn more, go to scottsports.com.
This episode of the Snow Brains podcast was edited by Jared White, music by Chad Crouch, and I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark.